Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Today we have a special episode with two guests who are here to pick up our spirits by making the case that there's a coming productivity boom, something that is much needed in the U.S. economy. Our first guest is Michael Mandel. Michael is a chief economic strategist at the Progressive Policy Institute, where he directs research across a wide range of topics, including the data-driven economy, the impact of regulation on innovation, and policies to improve production, investment, and job growth. Prior to that, he was a chief economist at Businessweek. Our second guest is Brent Swanson. Brett is the president of Entropy Economics, LLC, a strategic research firm specializing in technology, innovation, and the global economy. He is also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Today, they join us to talk about their new paper titled The Coming Productivity Boom, Transforming the Physical World with Information. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, David. Terrific to be here.
Well, tell us how you got into this topic of productivity. I know Michael's been working on this for a while, but tell us how you got into it and specifically into this paper.
That's a really good question. I think what happened is that the Technology CEO Council asked us to sort of look into this matter, and we realized that we had very similar views on it, very upbeat, and we were able to sort of combine our respective strengths and produce a paper that both had good economics in it, and also a lot of great examples.
Yeah, I've obviously been following Michael's work on productivity for years, almost two decades now.
Oh, don't make me feel old, Brett.
No. And, you know, that, like Michael said, the Tech CEO Council, a lot of tech companies that are producing a lot of innovative goods, they were also seeing the economic data, which was showing a pronounced productivity slowdown. So they came to us and asked, you know, can you figure this out? Can you help us figure this out? We see a lot of innovation out there, but the data don't necessarily show it. And so I, you know, focus a lot on actual technologies and actual firms and sort of brought that perspective. And that's also one thing I've also admired about Michael's work is that he's an economist who actually focuses on what's happening in the real economy as opposed to just the sort of abstractions of the aggregates.
That speaks to me right there. As a macroeconomist, I'm guilty as charged. It's nice to have you guys on the show because at heart, I believe I'm an eternal optimist. But you know, I've had a lot of guests on the show who have talked about the great stagnation, the slowdown of productivity growth. We want to get into that. So it's refreshing to have someone come in who has a thoughtful piece about that takes a more positive outlook on the future. And we'll have this article up on our website where the podcast is hosted so listeners can take a look at it. Let me begin by going over the kind of the general narrative that's out there that there has been a slowdown. Productivity has slowed down. Trend growth has slowed down. Robert Gordon has a huge book on this. John Fernald from the San Francisco Fed has written about this from the perspective of productivity growth. What's going on? What is your take on what has actually happened? Are they right?
Well, I think you're only giving a partial explanation of what's being talked about. There's two dystopian visions out there. One is the one that you described, which is no technological innovation, stagnation, slow growth as far as the eye can see. The other dystopian vision, of course, is these robots are taking over, boosting productivity tremendously and killing all the jobs. Right. And so these lie are being said at exactly the same time. And they're two very different views of the world. And because robots are taking all the jobs, actually it's incredible amounts of innovation, incredible amounts of transformation. Right. And it's happening so fast that there's nothing we can do about it. And you know what we realize is that it makes sense to think about the economy as being divided into a digital sector and a physical sector. The digital sector is about 25% of the private sector, and it includes a lot of digital industries where the output is easy to digitize. not just the internet, but financial services and professional services and so forth. And in these areas, it is true, innovation is happening really fast and productivity growth is very rapid. Then you've got the physical industries, which includes much of manufacturing, transportation, healthcare, even education, where the rate of transformation is very slow, where it's hard to digitize things. It's a process. It can be done, but you have to change the way you work as well. And in that part of the economy, productivity growth is incredibly slow. Wage growth is incredibly slow. And so your attitude towards what's happening is like the elephant, right? You know, whichever part you grasp onto is what you say is happening. So if you're in the digital sector, it feels like, wow, everything is being transformed tomorrow. And then if you're in the physical sector, the rate of productivity growth is really slow. And you sort of go and you look at individual industries and you say, I don't quite understand what's going on here, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of change. You know, for example, one of the examples that I really like is asphalt. Asphalt is manufactured, but price has soared because you haven't had a lot of productivity gains. And that's why actually a lot of towns and cities have letting a lot of their roads go back to gravel because asphalt is so expensive.
Hmm.
And you go and look around, you can find just lots of examples.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's very well said. But this also helps explain, I think, some of our recent political challenges, sort of our fraught political environment and what we saw in last year's election, where there was a lot of frustration across the country, I think probably due to, you know, low productivity and low income growth. But there was also a lot of misunderstandings between different parts of the country and different industries, between those who, you know, we're not seeing rapid income growth on the one hand and those who were seeing, you know, very rapid income growth and productivity growth on the other hand. And so this may help. I'm certainly no political scientist, but this also may help explain some of our recent politics.
Well, I think it's interesting because those two narratives are inconsistent with each other, right? In the sense that if robots are taking our jobs, why don't we see that in the aggregate numbers, right?
And it turns out if you actually look at the amount of investment in robots, it's really low. Okay. And most of it is going into the motor vehicle industry.
Yeah. No, I just think the robot narrative has probably, in the op-ed pages, has probably outstripped the reality.
I think it turns out to be harder to transform physical industries than you think with digitization because the physical world is very complicated. Think about autonomous vehicles. We can put an autonomous vehicle out on the street. Can it react to every possible instance? What happens if it gets broken down? How reliable does it have to be? And think about, you know, if you think about software programs getting flaky, well, you can't have a situation where your car gets flaky on you. And you can't, you know, you have this, you're going to have this vehicle, which is this combination of a complicated physical system and complicated software system. And yeah, we can eventually get it right. It's going to take a lot longer than people think. And I think that our biggest challenge economically is how do you take physical industries and digitize them? And a lot of what we wrote about in the paper was examples of how that's happening, which has the effect of boosting productivity and often creating new jobs.
Well, I want to go back to the apparent slowdown in the aggregate numbers. So this robot story, the robot narrative, and the people who are in the digital industry, they see it. But would this suggest that's a small part of the overall economy? Or is there more in the overall economy, but we're just not measuring it? Because there's been this debate that maybe there is more rapid gains, but we're just not seeing the actual measurement because of problems in GDP.
I think there are some very real measurement issues. Lots of really good economists have looked at this. I think we probably do underestimate innovation and productivity in some sectors. It's hard to count, you know, how health advances. Some of those don't show up in the data. There's very good work showing that we explicitly miscount overestimate the prices of many semiconductors. And yet the same economists who did that work, who showed this mismeasurement, also looked at how that fit into the overall economy. And they say, even if we are underestimating productivity in these various ways, and we give productivity a big boost, we still see a pronounced productivity slowdown over the last 10 years. So even if you account for those measurement challenges, which are very real in some cases, that means we would have had to have been counting correctly in previous eras. But there probably was mismeasurement back then, too. So the bottom line is that we think there has been a productivity slowdown.
Let me just add on to that. You know, I could regale you for hours with examples on both sides of undermeasurement and overmeasurement of substantial size, you know. And some of them are really prosaic. You know, the price of burial caskets has gone way up. Is that reflect a real price gain, or has there been a quality improvement? Well, you know, that's a really hard question to answer. But, you know, at the end of the day, I look at the reaction of people and how they feel. And it's clear that people feel like their real living standard has not gone up and they're worried about their kids. So when I sit down and I ask this question, I say, in the end, the slowdown looks real because that's what people are telling me.
All right. So at least it's perceived as real. And these studies that you've mentioned, Brett, also suggest that it's real as well, even after you account for mismeasurements.
Yeah, I think if there's deep problems in our statistical system at this point in terms of how do you deal with a data-driven economy on both the plus and the minus side. And then also how you think about life expectancy. Because in fact, we know about the fall in life expectancy for certain groups.
Yep.
And honestly, we should be counting that in as well. And so at this point now, we're really, if you're thinking about mismeasurement, you don't really want to think about mismeasurement anymore. You want to think about what sort of new framework do you actually need to deal with a data-driven economy where your productive activity is not simply located in one country. We do the best we can. You know, we use at this point the conventional statistics like everybody else does, but you got to keep in the back of your mind that this is not mismeasurement in the conventional sense, but it may be that we actually need to think about a new framework for a data-driven economy. What are we going to measure? What are our indicators going to be? Maybe very different than they were in the past.
Now, for our listeners, I'll let them know that Michael has been very vocal about this issue in the past. I remember your earlier work on measuring the productivity boom early to mid-2000s. So you've been pushing for better measurements. So where would you have them go? Do you have any suggestions in terms of a better measure of welfare or progress?
Well, let me just make the first obligatory statement. Uh-huh. There's very smart statisticians in the government, and if we give them more money, there's a lot that they can do to improve what we have.
Okay.
The real question here is, what is our goal? Because GDP, if you remember, was invented in the 30s and 40s for two purposes. First, to track the downturn. The depression, and second, to assess the war-fighting capacity of the U.S. in the 1940s. And if you think about the second one, it's kind of interesting. What would we need to know now to understand what our capabilities are? Because we'd have to think about what kind of war we want to fight. And then the third question that people is standards of living. And you can go back and forth, but I suspect, Brett, you'd have to think about things like life expectancy. You have to think about education. There's a lot of things you want to think about as part of a good life at this point, which is not in the statistics right now.
Well, something I've wondered, and I've asked some previous guests. I had Jason Furman on. I asked him because he is with the CEA, and I'll ask you guys, since you guys are technology specialists, why don't we have more real-time measures? So I have friends who work with hedge funds, and they look at real-time debit card, credit card, consolidated. They can tell instantly what's happening. And there's big seasonality issues. You're not maybe getting truly value-added measures. You're just getting transactions. But why isn't there some kind of weekly, some higher frequency measures that we're not getting from the government right now?
Well, let me just give you one example. It's a really good question, and I think we could get more data if we, you know, tried, or maybe it's maybe it is an issue of money setting up new, pilot programs in some of our economic bureaus and so forth. But one of the studies I referred to from David Byrne and Steve Olliner and Dan Sitchell, they found a specific problem with the way we were counting the prices of microprocessors over the last 15 years, where the official producer price index says that there is a annual 6% decline in the price of microprocessors, you know, quality constant, where, you know, if we believe in Moore's law, that should have been much larger. Well, what happened about 2005, Intel, world's biggest producer of microprocessors, changed the way it basically priced. And the government kept on using the list prices, even though the actual prices that companies building PCs or building servers in the cloud paid for these microprocessors changed dramatically compared to the list price. So when they used actual prices over the last, say, dozen years, they found that microprocessors had been declining 42% per year.
Wow.
So you compare 6% to 42%, that is, you know, that basically tells you that Moore's law in effect is alive and well. One example of exactly what you're saying, using more actual, not real time, but closer to real time data.
We can get real time data now. Real time data is great, but the time you really want it is at a turning point where things are changing very rapidly in the economy. And unfortunately, that's also the time when relationships between the real time data and the conventional macroeconomic aggregates break down as well. So in my view, actually, the ideal situation is sort of times of normalcy to rely on a lot of the real-time data because to use the government surveys just to benchmark. Then actually what you need is more government surveys when things look like they're changing very fast, because that's how you can really track it, because they're real-time relationships, just like the financial markets broke down, the real-time relationships and the data break down too. So you got to be clever about the way you integrate the real-time data, what they call administrative data or organic data, with the government survey data. You know, the government survey data, you actually know what you're looking at because you've got the right sample frame. With the administrative or organic data, you don't know exactly what you're looking at. It's cheaper to use. It's more real-time, but it will break down unpredictably. And I should say at this point, I've got a grant from the Sloan Foundation to look actually at some of the uses of organic data in just this sort of way. It's a fascinating subject. I could go on for hours.
Well, that's unfortunate that it does break down at turning points, because that's when you need it, because you know the surveys are going to take time, right?
I mean, not necessarily. Okay. You could put in a capability. In times like 2008, for doing multiple fast turnaround surveys, government surveys, you could do that if you were set up. This is what I mean. We have to be kind of clever about this and figure out what we're really concerned about. Because that going back and looking, say that's when we needed better data. We can ask a very specific question. It's not an abstract question. What could we have done over that period to give us a really close measure of what was going on? And I think the simplest idea then is actually supplementary government surveys, because my sense is that the administrative or organic data becomes less reliable. What happens, for example, in job postings is that you may have companies posting as many job postings that they did before, but all of a sudden they're not filling jobs. And you won't know that until you won't know that until afterwards. So traditional relationships will break down, or in the credit card aggregates. Well, when you see this sharp slowdown, is this actually a sign that the economy is collapsing, or is this a sign of good adjustment?
Right, and there's structural change too. There's are people using more credit cards? Yep. Are they using cryptocurrency? I mean, there's a lot of things that happen that we can't
quickly at down yeah. at turning points. And so, but this is what I mean is when you think about redoing our statistics, you have to the needs of real time macro policy are very different than the needs of defense capabilities.
Yep.
And are very different yep. than social indicators. And the three shouldn't be confused with each other.
Well, Michael, we look forward to your report on this. Pushes in the right direction. Well, let's get back to this big point that really motivates the study, at least in part, and that is the slowdown. And what I've heard you guys say so far is it is real, even after accounting for measurement problems. And I had a hard time accepting this at first. I'll tell you my personal take. You know, I look at my smartphone, all these apps on there that do things that were formerly a part of GDP, everything from music to books to compass to maps, things I used to pay. So I kind of bought, yeah, it's understating. But these articles these Fed economists put out convinced me that there's more to it than that. I think what really hit me, though, is a couple two things, and I mentioned this in the Tyler Cowen interview. Number one, if you look at total factor productivity trend growth relative to where it was going before, you know, the 70s, it clearly has fallen down. So the question is, you know, not that we live in a great time of improvement. It's where we could have been had we kept up that pace, I think. And I you know, think of technology. So Peter Thiel has this famous saying out, famous quote: "We wanted flying cars, instead we got 140 characters." Right? Why aren't we in that alternative universe? Why didn't productivity growth keep up and deliver us that reality versus the one we have?
I think that's a great question. It sort of gets to the heart of our study, and you know, it's sort of the atoms versus bits perspective that Thiel has put forward, and I think that encapsulates a lot of what's going on here. So part of it's what Michael was saying before about, you know, we had these new digital tools with the computer revolution and the internet, and the easiest places in which to use those tools were the already information-rich parts of the economy. So whether that was media, whether that was finance, things that were easily digitized, as he said. The physical world just turns out to be much more difficult to exploit with these new information tools. That might be part of it. I think another big part of it is the fact that a lot of these physical industries are also much more heavily regulated. So it's much more difficult to run new experiments via entrepreneurial firms, launch new products and services, in some of these fields like healthcare and education and manufacturing and energy. So it turned the digital world, the digital economy also happened to be the part of the economy that had the most free rein to experiment and innovate.
I would sort of add at this point is that the process of digitizing physical industries, well, you mentioned your smartphone. You know, your smartphone is great for sort of looking at videos and downloading information. Okay? You can't actually teleport food onto it. It just doesn't work that way. If you order a food on it, it still has to be delivered by car.
Right.
All right. It has to be made in a kitchen. And this was the mistake, actually, that the early e-tailers made in the 1990s. They said, okay, we'll slap up a website and we're done. This we've now digitized retail. Well, it turned out that retail was a little bit about how people ordered and a lot about how the goods get delivered, get from the manufacturer to the person. And, you know, the initial e-tailers, you know, just died for the most part, you know, with Amazon being a notable exception. And so now we are 20 years later, and what's happening is we're actually finally seeing the digitization of retail. And it turns out not to be about digital per se, but turns out to be building these high-tech fulfillment centers, which can turn around and get goods to people in a day, right? The turning point of this was sort of realizing, you know, when people shop, they want immediate gratification. And immediate gratification is, you know, defined as very rapid. And that's very difficult to do. and it requires really sophisticated digital engineering. And it also employs a lot of people, and it raises productivity. And incidentally, it may create new capabilities that, say, manufacturers can use to offer custom manufacturing to people with really fast turnaround. And so what we're looking at this point is actually the digitization of retail, which has the effect of creating jobs, creating better paid jobs. But it looks different than what we expected it to look. It involves a lot of physical plants being built in places like Tennessee and Kentucky and Indiana and Ohio and Oklahoma and Pennsylvania, all right? It involves physicalness. And that's what I think, you know, Brett mentioned this, the essence of this paper is saying turning atoms into bits. It's a process. It's a long process, but it's happening. And as it happens, it has the effect of raising productivity and incidentally creating jobs as well.
You mentioned Tennessee. I live in Tennessee, as I think my listeners know. And there's an Amazon warehouse not too far from me in Lebanon. I live in Nashville. Lebanon's just outside. It's huge, huge. And so that facility is built. I'm just waiting for the day when the drones will pick up the package from that warehouse, come to my home, and drop them off.
Well, I don't know. What you really want to think about is you go back to the development of the auto industry. There weren't actually all that many people who worked in the auto industry. What was important was all of the spin-off industries that were created. So right now we're building an advanced distribution industry in the U.S., which is able to get stuff to people really quickly. Well, you know, does that mean that all of a sudden manufacturers want to locate near the advanced distribution facilities so they can quickly turn around stuff to consumers? And will that create a new and different type of manufacturing in the U.S. that has a durable competitive advantage against foreign suppliers? I mean, you have to sort of step back and say, when we transform physical industries, and I know that Brett has a lot to say about this. And Brett supplied all sorts of great examples for this paper, okay, about what you can actually do, not just simply substitution of capital for labor, substitution of robots for people, but when we really look historically at productivity growth, you create new capabilities that get used in ways that create new industries and new products, new services that employ more people.
Well, let's move into that. In your paper, you list some key areas, some key technology areas that are driving change. And I want to read them off, and then you tell me in a practical sense how these things are actually being developed and seen in the physical world. So you mentioned mobile technology, big data, ubiquitous sensors, computer vision, robotics, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, 5G wireless. So you draw upon some of those, Brett, and tell us how we are beginning to see some of the transformation in the physical world through them.
Sure. Just a few examples from the last few years where we're getting some really promising signs of what is coming. I'd give two examples, one in transportation. So the rise of Uber and Lyft and the first data, these ride-sharing services, that have just exploded. And the first data we're getting from them actually shows that they are far more efficient than the old taxi services. So they actually carry people in the cars a far greater percentage of the time that they are running, some, you know, 40 to 50% more time with a passenger in the car. And these have just been, in addition to the ease of use and the convenience and the feedback that the digital app gives you. And so this is, you know, this wasn't a huge new technological invention. It was just a smart application of a lot of these mobile and software tools that were starting to be used, and a creative use of a new app connecting software and mobile with a very physical industry of moving people around cities. And we're already seeing just the tip of the iceberg that it's already more productive. Now you can go on and think about where that's going with autonomous cars and so forth. Another example where that's very encouraging is another of the most physical industries, energy extraction. So in the, you know, mid part of the last decade, 2005, 2006, we were supposedly at peak oil. Oil prices were sky high. We were supposedly running out of it. And then the shale revolution hit. And a big part of the, we'd known about shale rock for the last 100 years. That was a very petroleum-rich source, but we didn't know how to get at it. And so through the combination of some very physical processes, so horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, along with very digital processes, namely 3D computer modeling of undersurface shale formations, we were able to pinpoint these drills miles and miles under the ground and fracture them in just the right place to release unimaginable amounts of oil and gas. And so in the last decade, we've gone, the U.S. has basically doubled its daily production of oil, a huge increase of natural gas, which is, good for electricity generation and good for every other industry. We've lowered our CO2 emissions because natural gas is much lower in CO2 content than coal. And so those are just two ways that information technologies are transforming sort of some of the most physical industries.
Let me add one thing onto what Brett said. So the application of information technology to energy extraction had the effect of increasing employment, not just of highly skilled petroleum engineers, but also of the people doing the actual drilling. And this is actually what we find pretty much consistently. Forget the fear of the robot people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What happens when you apply information on net, the digital sector has actually been creating jobs at a faster rate than the physical sector because it's low. The prices are lower. The demand is higher. It's stuff that people want. So we apply digitization to energy extraction. And we didn't automate away these people. We created more demand for them. I think this is a pretty consistent message. Now, you go back, you have the Uber example. We don't have actually the data that allows us to say, has this increased or decreased employment? There's a lot of debate about this. The data is very flaky. And I think what you will find is that if this is really a truly an increase in productivity, so you can lower the price of rides, it'll increase the demand. People will stop using cars so much, they'll start shifting to whatever the ride sharing application is out there, whether it's Uber or Lyft or something else. And the demand will go up because you'll have a transfer of time that people drive themselves to drivers that are paying. And what that ends up doing is that it ends up increasing the amount of time that people have it and reduces the amount they're going to be paying for transportation, which is this enormous share of people's budget. You have no idea. I can't remember the exact number, but a big chunk of people's budget goes for maintaining cars, basically. And if we can take out even a bit of that, you're well on the way of increasing living standards. And, so when I look at Uber and Lyft, I see this as the growing pains of the applications of information technology to a physical industry. You started off by asking about flying cars. Well, this is not flying cars, but this is cars that get you where you're going without you actually having to spend the time maintaining it.
And in Pittsburgh, right, there's driverless Uber cars, right?
Here's the...
Yeah, all sorts of pilot programs, Pittsburgh, some other places. Mm-hmm. There's a useful debate about, in a lot of ways, the driverless car technology has come on faster than a lot of people thought. And then there are others that are saying, wait a minute, there's still a lot of issues and challenges that we have to solve to make these things really, truly safe and so forth. But we've also seen driverless trucks. There was the case of the driverless truck that delivered a cold beer across a couple hundred miles on highways and did just fine. So there's a lot of really encouraging evidence on the technology, but it's going to be another, number of years before it's commonplace.
Let me talk about driverless trucks for a second from both angles, which is really, so trucking has been an industry which has, has had a slowdown in productivity growth. And so actually the cost of distribution is a big cost part of the, when you go in and pay for clothing or food, mm-hmm. or anything, the cost of distribution is a big chunk of what you're paying for. To the extent to which you can lower that, you can lower the cost to the consumer. If you lower the cost to the consumer, you perhaps increase the demand. You perhaps, you know, open up the possibility for new markets that didn't exist. And I think this is what we have to sort of think about. When I hear that people sort of talk about, you know, 50% of jobs are potentially affected by automation. You know, I go back to the late 1800s, and you could have written an article saying, you know, 75% of jobs are potentially affected by electrification. Yes, right? It's true. There's no way that right, absolutely right. true. I could have written, and I'm sure people did, or by the steam engine. Right? And when you have new technologies come in, mm-hmm. they're real quick. I want to sort of make a careful distinction here. There's the macro positive effect. And then what we've learned is we seriously have to worry about people being left behind. Let me actually just, before we move on, let me just talk about that in terms of the energy extraction. Yeah. So the number of mining jobs in the country since 2000 has gone up a lot. The number of coal mining jobs has gone down. Coal mining jobs are concentrated in a couple of states, have really hurt those states. So it doesn't actually help those people that there's been overall growth in mining jobs. Their communities have been hurt. I think we have to think about that we can have good macroeconomic effects from productivity gains, not just in terms of productivity, but in terms of job growth and wages and all the things we love, and realize that there are people that are going to be left behind by this. And we have to, for a lot of reasons, just take this very, very seriously. So we started off talking about optimism. Yeah, it's optimism, but with understanding that when people complain that that there are people being left behind, absolutely true.
I mean, a good example of that would be truck drivers. That's one of the few professions left where you don't have to have a lot of education. You can make a decent income. And if it does go the way of driverless trucks, now, Brett, you said it may be a few years before we get there. But when this does happen, that's one more job that's disappeared from kind of the lower socioeconomic employee, right?
It's a real question, as Michael was saying. I think you've got to think about, though, the other new business models that this opens up. You know, if I can operate a fleet of trucks, you know, maybe I can buy two or three or five trucks. I know... and operate a fleet that is serving a specialized market, serving some specific customers, that might be a tremendous opportunity for a, you know, former truck driver. So you have to weigh those possible gains against some of the losses. But as Michael said, these, you know, you may have to think about specific people that are hurt by very rapid dislocations like the coal miners. But then you also have to, you know, think about the overall growth effects that not only will benefit the whole economy, but that will allow us to perhaps offer targeted benefits or transition assistance and so forth to some of these very specific communities. And I think one of the big problems over the last 10 years has been the fact that we've had a few of these dislocations, whether it was from China or whether it was from technology. At the same time, we've had very slow economic growth. And so they've sort of been a double whammy.
Right.
If we'd had better economic growth with the dislocations, it would have allowed more job opportunities for people to switch. It would have allowed the government budgets to help in other ways that government can help. But that's the thing, is that you want a dynamic economy that is growing fast enough so that the inevitable dislocations, whether from trade or technology or consumer tastes, we allow for the people most vulnerable to move on.
No, I agree. And I didn't mean to make the impression those poor truck drivers. I believe they too ultimately be better off as this happens.
I think you raise a good question. I think Brett and I both believe that it's important to seriously consider this. We don't sort of shove this under the rug. We just think that history suggests that the innovations that generate growth also generate new opportunities. and that create a big enough pie that if, you know, you can do something.
Well, you mentioned before the show a great example I hadn't heard of. Tell us about Facebook's new hiring. Who are they hiring?
Well, I think, you know, Facebook has been accused of not having enough workers. Okay. And, you know, I've looked at this, and basically if you compare Facebook to GM at the same age, and they basically are on the GM path, right? They've got very rapid growth. They're just relatively young. And now what they've said is that they're going to hire workers to help sort of stamp out fake news. And I think this is really, I think if you kind of understand the whole process, you have a new technology, it generates new problems and new opportunities, and it generates new jobs. And I think partly what we've seen here, I think about this as building guardrails on highways, that if you can go ahead and you can build a highway out there, and you build it without guardrails, because why does anybody need a guardrail? We're all good drivers. And then you have a couple of people go off the side. And you say, you know, I really need to put out guardrails. And you have you send another crew out to build guardrails. And then you send the crew out to sort of fill in potholes. And every year, because you get, and all of a sudden what looked like a one shot becomes a process, becomes an industry, becomes a sector. And you know, you've got the guardrails, and all of a sudden, you know, your aged parents can drive along the road now, and they can go shop wherever they want, and they create new jobs. I mean, the thing is that we see this process happening, and we see it starting to permeate the physical industries. And part of our optimism is, yeah, this process is slow, but it's happening. And it will create faster productivity growth. And it may very well, if I look out 5 or 10 years, one of the things that we've learned is that it's really tough to predict productivity growth 10 years from now from what it was over the last 10 years. And I, you know, what Brett and I both believe is that we're in a situation where the future is happening, and it's not happening in the dystopian way of stagnation, and it's not happening in a dystopian way of, oh my God, the robots are eating us all. But in fact, it's happening in a way that's going to raise wages and create jobs that are good overall for people.
Yeah, I like that Facebook example, because it's a clear example of new technology creates a new problem, then it creates new jobs to fix that problem. And your point is, this will be a process that continues as we see more and more of this information applied to the digital world. Brett, you had something?
That's right. And yeah, David, I just wanted to sort of step back and go to one of the core findings of our paper, which I think quantifies the magnitude of the opportunity here. So the way we divided up the economy into basically, you know, two groups, the digital industries and the physical industries. The digital industries are about 30% of private GDP output. The physical industries are 70%. But the digital industries make 70% of all the investments in information technology. The 30% or the 70% of the economy that's physical makes only 30% of the investments in information technology. And there's a massive productivity differential. So what you are saying here is basically this is a big problem. It has drugged down growth for the last decade or more, but it's also, on the flip side, a huge opportunity. It means that, you know, 3/4 of the economy is underperforming. And if we could get 3/4 of the economy growing faster, innovating faster, that it has large macroeconomic effects.
Well, that's very encouraging, right? That's low-hanging fruit there. I mean, maybe it's not low-hanging. It's fruit that needs to be pulled and picked.
I think the phrase low-hanging fruit is difficult. I think what we want to think about, that you build ladders and you climb up, and you've got to sort of take the fruit, and then you've got to process it a bit and so forth, and maybe turn it into wine. It's just, you know, this is, we're talking about, we're not talking about computer games. We're talking about objects in the physical world. We're talking about people that you've got to be careful with. And it's a process that takes time. But it's, well, you know, every place we look, we see examples of it happening. And I just wanted to point out one thing. You go back to 2006, and which is just before the introduction of the iPhone, and just before fracking really sort of took off. And you see no evidence in the business press that these two enormous technological events were about to happen. Actually, I should let Brett actually predicted it at the time. Okay. Okay.
Good
I shouldn't
for you,
say,
Brett.
I shouldn't say that. Brett actually predicted it, as he pointed out to me. But it's vanishingly small. That our ability to predict technological breakthroughs, even at very short distances, is difficult. It's hard to remember just how young Facebook is. It's hard to remember just how young Uber is. It's hard to it's hard to remember that the smartphone is less than 10 years old.
It's pervasive now, but
Think about how fast it spread and how many jobs it created for app developers and how many. And so I want to add, we also quantified the amount of growth that we would get over the next 15 years as the physical sector sort of adopted some of these technologies, and the amount of additional growth and additional GDP and higher wages and more taxes you get is potentially enormous.
Well, if 70% of GDP right now isn't fully utilizing this, that's a huge, huge opportunity, right? Let's speculate here. I want to have a little fun with you guys. So some of these technologies you've listed, robotics, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, let's just think forward. What will our world look like when 3D printing, for example, really blossoms? Will we see a decline in retail? Will we all have 3D machines in our home making everything from tools to clothes? And what is your vision of what 3D printing will do for us? Brett?
Yeah. I think you already see lots of hobbyists using it. And I think there will be new businesses started with, creating all sorts of customized products, whether they're sort of mechanical products, or maybe it's customized clothing or customized accessories or customized sports equipment or, customizing parts for your drone. But there are all sorts of, industrial size companies that are rapidly deploying 3D printing, not just for prototyping, which is one obvious case that's already being used, but for creating objects that we've never been able to make before because we weren't able to fabricate them using our traditional casting processes or, forging processes. And that allows, mechanical engineers and others to design machines in ways that were never available before. So there'll be lots of innovation there. I know that some, our local dentists and orthodontists are already using 3D printers to print out appliances based on 3D models of your, mouth and teeth in their offices, which allows, speeds up the process of, and lowers the cost of, dentistry and orthodontia. So I think that it's going to, sort of like the PC was, there's going to be lots of hobbying that turns into, small businesses. And then there's also going to be lots of industrial scale type stuff as well.
I read an article about a neurosurgeon who does 3D printing before he goes into surgery. He does kind of a dress rehearsal he scans the brain, he prints the person's brain, he works on it, and then he goes in and does the actual surgery. So his productivity is shot way up because of this 3D printing.
I as long as we're on the healthcare, I think one of the interesting things to think about is artificial organs.
Mm.
And as a new manufacturing industry, whether or not they're 3D printed or sort of grown, I'm not sure that everything has to be. You sort of grow cells on a scaffolding. Maybe the scaffolding is 3D printed, and then the cells are grown.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and to the degree to which that this becomes practical, this think about the demand. Think about the creation of a new industry that did not exist before with a new product. This is where what Brett was talking about. You can't simply stop and say, oh, we can do what we were doing before cheaper, because that's like saying, okay, we're going to put together an assembly line to build horse-drawn carriages. Hmm. You know, we could do it cheaper, but that's not the point. The point is that we could do something that we couldn't do before and make it cheap enough that people could buy it. And where we are, and you know, this is the miracle of the smartphone. It's not that we couldn't construct a small computer before, which is what it really is that we could do it in cheap enough to make it accessible, not just in the US and not just in Japan and not just in Europe, but around the world, to the degree to which this has become almost ubiquitous. And this is really what you've got to think about. You have to think about what the future of falling prices look like for new things that we did not know that we needed, that at the point where it comes out becomes immediately obvious that you need it. And like I said, there's a difficulty doing technological forecasting, but
yeah,
you know, nobody knew that they needed Uber before Uber started.
And what this speaks to is we need a sense of humility, right? To not get overly pessimistic about the future, to understand these things are happening, to have a broad vision and a sense of humility that radical transformation can occur. Let me do one more of these industries with you, Brett, as an example. What about 5G wireless? How is that going to change our world?
Well, in many ways, 5G wireless, the next generation of wireless technology, will be a foundation for many of these technologies and industries. Obviously, the communications network is already a key platform for the economy, but it will only become more so going forward. So whether you're talking about connecting tens of billions of little sensors in what we call the Internet of Things, as we put little sensors, on trash cans or on pill bottles or on packages or in machinery or in our bodies, collecting all this data wirelessly will require a network that is far more ubiquitous, with more capability, that's faster than ever before. And so this new 5G network will be made of millions of new small cells. So you think about cell towers now. In the radius that we now have a cell tower, we may have many dozens of these small cells on street corners, on office buildings, in neighborhoods, on campuses, on lampposts, utility poles, and it'll be necessary for the Internet of Things. It'll be necessary for connected cars. It will be obvious. It'll be in addition to the obvious uses of connecting our phones and our residential and enterprise broadband, making sure that we have enough wireless capacity to do virtual reality and augmented reality and 8K cinema. And so it really will be the foundation of so many of these different industries. And it's a project that will, it'll take $200 billion of new investment to build this out across the nation.
I've heard it discussed in the context of driverless cars in particular, that it will be key to making them operational, to connect with each other. Let me ask one other thing. Michael's talking about health. This is not meant to be dystopian, but what about like cyborgs? Like as humans, we have more computer implants, maybe something to enhance my IQ, things like that. Do you see that on the horizon?
How would you feel about that? Suppose that I could offer you a pill that would improve your IQ by 25%. Would you take it?
Be very tempted.
Be very tempted.
Right.
And I think we have to understand that that we've spent $1 trillion in the U.S. on private and public R&D into biosciences. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen but a fraction of the payoff of that yet. And as the payoff of that kind of rolls out, there are things that will happen that will raise issues, both positive and negative, that we're not even kind of cognizant of right now. So, productivity is one thing, but remember, with the car came the suburbs, and came all sorts of other issues. You know, it was a social transformation as well. So we talk here about productivity, and honestly, I mean, I think if you asked both of us, we would agree that the odds of productivity gains accelerating is really high at this point. Then we have to think about what comes along with that too. It isn't simply about doing what we're doing now more efficiently. It's about doing different things, and the healthcare system will look different. The education system will look different. The driving system will look different. Retailing will look different. And our goal is to sort of navigate through this in a way that improves people's welfare.
Very interesting. Brett, anything else you want to add to that?
Well, I'd just say there are some, as Michael said, and as you suggested, some problems with technological forecasting and what that will do mm-hmm. to society and culture. And there may be some ethical issues. I think it's in large part, it will have mostly beneficial effects of delivering better health for people to have higher standards of living for more of their lives. But there are going to be some challenges and some temptations that maybe we don't want to go with. But I'd just say that in the next 15 years, I think we're going to see huge advances in healthcare, which is one of our most challenged industries as far as productivity and one of our largest. You know, we're supposed today at 17% of the economy, it's supposed to grow to 20%. And it's just far, far too expensive for what we're getting out of it. But I think there are a number of ways, whether it's through personal technology, we're finally about to see the real fruits of the genomic and proteomic revolutions. It's going to, reduce the cost of drug development. So I'm really excited about healthcare because it's such a large part of the economy and so expensive, that also means it's a huge opportunity.
Well, our time is up, but this has been a very refreshing and positive message. A productivity boom is on the horizon, and we have great social change to look forward to, but great opportunity as well. Our guests today have been Michael Mandel and Brett Swanson. Michael and Brett, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you, David.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.